हरिः ॐ सहना भवतु सहना भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्रीहद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरिगौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे.
The soul experiences the external world through the mind and senses. All the cognition and conscious states arise in the soul when the soul is related to the mind to the senses, and senses to the external objects. It is because of this sequential contact or relationship that the whole process actuates. Otherwise, there would be no consciousness in the soul. In its disembodied or disintegrated state, the soul has no knowledge or consciousness. How then can one know whether there is such a thing as an individual soul? The Nyaya system answers that the soul is not known by sensory perception, but rather by inference or testimony. The existence of the soul is inferred from the functions of desire, aversion, volition, from the sensations of pain and pleasure, and from memory of these. These memories cannot be explained unless one admits a permanent soul that has experienced pain and pleasure in relation to certain objects in the past. The process of knowledge based on memory requires to exist. Requires the existence of a permanent self that desires to know something and then desires to obtain certain knowledge about it. Desire, volition, pain, and pleasure cannot be explained by the body, senses, or mind, just as the experience of one person cannot be remembered by another person. The present state of the body or the senses or the mind cannot remember their past states. The phenomenon of memory must depend upon a permanent entity, the soul. One's own soul can be known through mental perception, but someone else's soul in another body can only be inferred. Right? So they're establishing then the position of the soul. Right? And so they've established that it can't be consciousness, it has to be more than consciousness, that and it possesses consciousness. Right? Then here then it's saying that we experience what's around us because the soul, there's consciousness. Consciousness is connected to the mind. The mind is connected to the senses to the sense objects. That way then one knows what's going on around one. One is connected. Then there are the subtler aspects through the senses that, along with what one perceives with the senses, then there are the extraordinary things that one perceives. Right? Through and that, then therefore, oh, this whole explanation of memory. Because the extraordinary elements then are based on memory, experiences that are before that you can somehow or another connect to the present situation. Right? So this process becomes important because if you think about it, then in this explains that the only connection that you have with what you see, right, that you count as real, is through the senses. Therefore through the mind, because the mind then interprets what is there. Then that is based on memory gained from intelligence, right? And then ultimately it goes back to the consciousness. What is one's consciousness? It's spiritual material. So it's through the senses that everything's to be known. Therefore, it's the engagement of the senses in the Lord's service, right? So when we say, Hrishikesha, Hrishikena, Sevanam, Bhakti, Ruchite, that the Lord of the senses means engaging the senses in the service of the Lord of the senses, it does cover everything. Because body, mind, and words. The body is the physical form through which the senses are acting. Right? The body is interacting with other things that are perceived through the senses. Right? Then you have the intelligence itself, body, mind, Okay, the mind is what is perceiving what is being brought in through the senses and deciding on what's there, what's good or bad. And then the words means the senses. Because of all the word, of all the senses, what you speak, then you can understand what how you think. So, therefore, you're having the body, the mind, and the senses. Right? But the body is the seat of the senses. The body is what is perceived by the senses. And the mind is what's doing that interpretation. So you say body, mind, and words. The whole process is still dealing with the senses. Right? So it's important to note this. So that means service means engaging the senses. Not doing anything with the senses. Okay, not doing something with the senses is better than using the senses improperly. Right? We have the senses, we misapply them, that's not good. So better than that is not using the senses at all. But that is a very temporary situation. Using the senses is the natural permanent situation. So therefore, when the senses are engaged in the service of the Lord of the senses, then the whole process starts to work. Right? We see in analyzation of the material energy, the 24 elements, of the 24 elements, you're dealing basically, I think, 20 of them with the senses. Right? You have the five sense objects, the tanmatras, the sense itself. No, you have the sense object, but then you have the sense object, you have the sense. So five senses, five sense objects. Then you have the concept of the sense. In other words, smell, taste, touch. You know, I say it's an inherent nature of something. It's not the sense itself. It's not the sense object. It is actually the nature of the sense. You understand?
Right.
That's the senses, yes. But then you have, but what does he mean? In other words, let's say you have form. Okay? So form is what the eyes see. You understand? So the eyes are seeing form. So there's three different things. So if you have five senses, that means you have to have five sense objects. And you have to have the five things that are connecting, which is the sense itself. The senses, the sense, and the sense objects. Right? So that's 15. Right? Then you have the working senses. That's 20. Right? Then you have mind, intelligence, false ego. That's 23. And then polluted consciousness. Right? So, yes. Can we a little bit louder? Those are all connected. It means that the five gross elements would be, because from the gross element comes, from ether comes sound, right? From air comes touch, from water comes taste, from fire comes form, and from earth comes smell. So then you have those, yeah, it means those are non-different. But my point is that 20 of them are dealing with the senses, right? And the sense objects are made out of the five elements. So the senses, the sense objects, the mind, the intelligence, the false ego, and the consciousness. So that whole process, then you have the polluted consciousness then deals with the mind. The mind accesses the intelligence that bases its acceptance and rejection on its false ego. Then it's taking in information from the senses dealing with the sense objects. Right? And then deciding on what's there. Then you say, this is my world. Does that make sense? Kind of. It's always interesting when you're talking about senses and then you want to know if they understand it, so you say, does that make sense? I guess it would also be the same problem if you're discussing economics, so does that make sense?
Yes.
So does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita that there is eight elements? That means that the senses are included in the five gross elements?
The five gross elements, you get the senses, the sense objects, right? And the tan matras, everything comes out of there. That's why sometimes they explain it as there's nine elements. Like Brahma Samhita says there's only nine material elements. So it's taking the Mahabhutas and they said. Yeah. Because the mind means it includes all the senses and everything. So 15 come out of there. So then your gross elements, your subtle, and the mind includes all the senses. Right? And then you have consciousness. So you could say the eight elements in consciousness, you have everything. Right? But Lord Chaitanya uses the 24. Because then it's very clear. Because otherwise there may be differences of opinion in when you're dealing with the mind, how many that includes. Because it should include 16. The mind itself should be 16. Right? Does that make sense? So 16 plus 8 is 24. So the mind, 15 other things, that's count as one because you can't separate. The senses don't function without the mind. The mind doesn't have any meaning without the senses. Does that make sense? Because even you say, I'm not seeing anything, or, you know, I'm not engaging the senses, but then you're working on memory. And that memory means past engagement of the senses and the sense objects. Does that make sense? Yeah, so you can't separate the mind and the senses. That's why you can count them as 16 different things, or you can take them as one. Or sometimes because the Mahabhutas, the gross elements, they include the five sensory elements. So then you'll take the senses as 10, and then the mind is the 11th sense. You can also do it that way. But if you're putting more emphasis on the engagement of the mind and the senses rather than the form, right, then instead of the five, the Mahabhutas, the earth, water, fire, air, ether, you use, smell, taste, touch, form, and hearing. Right. Does that make sense? Or seeing and hearing. Okay? So basically the point is that the soul is there, so then the soul has to be eternal because you're working on memories. And those memories then are going back into previous lives. So unless the soul lasts, how do you function on with memories? So the combination of what you're perceiving now and combine that with memories, that then makes up what is the consciousness of the living entity. Right? So you can't separate all those. You can't, of course, you can identify, but at the same time, as in functioning, they all work together. You can only tell, so yourself, you are able to perceive that you're existing and all these functions are going on. But in another living entity, you have to do it through inference. Right? Does that make sense? Because you can't directly experience the other soul. Right, so through inference you're able to. That makes sense. It means they're living, so that must mean that there's something inside there. Either that or there's a very large battery. Right? So you check. If there's no switch and no batteries, then there's a soul inside. Right? Like that t-shirt, says soul inside. Okay. Anything else? No. The concept of liberation. Like all the other systems of Indian philosophy, the Nyaya system maintains that the ultimate goal of human life is to obtain liberation. By liberation is meant absolute freedom from all pain and misery. Yeah. like I was saying before, is this, it was probably important, this desire, pain, pleasure, all these things, you can't explain by the body as dead matter, or the senses, they just sit there, right? Or the mind itself, right? There must be something more that is there. So it can only be explained if the soul is there. Does that make sense? So now, is that, now they're trying to establish a liberation. This is their concept of liberation. So they all are preaching liberation, but now what that liberation means. Right? Does that make sense? You know, you're in the class, you're not very comfortable, then the class is over, so you're freed, you're liberated from the state of being in class. Right? Does that make sense? So what is their definition of liberation? Liberation means being freed from something that generally you don't really much appreciate. Right? Because the materialist is not worried about liberation because he actually thinks it's very nice being absorbed in the material energy. But for someone who's more conscious, then that being absorbed in material energy is a disturbance, so therefore they want to be freed from it. By liberation is meant absolute freedom from all pain and misery. This implies a state in which the soul is completely released from all bondage and from its connection with the body. It is impossible for the soul to obtain the state of complete freedom from pain and misery unless the soul is totally disconnected from the body and senses. In liberation, the soul is unconditionally and absolutely free from all shackles forever. Right? This is their idea. Because they always say it's forever. Why are they saying forever? Okay, yeah, conditioned by time and space, so they're looking at it from there. But what is the motive behind saying it's forever? Is it actually a spiritual reality, or it's an emotional feeling or desire? You understand? So it's because it's miserable here, it's so much they want to, just like they want to be happy forever, so they want to not be in pain forever. But that's a state of the mind, right? You know what I'm saying? Ultimately, it goes back to the soul, because the soul being Satchidananda, there's no such thing actually as misery or pain in the nature of the soul. Its nature is ananda or happiness, right? So it can't relate to that really. So then, just as they are eternal, so they always will think of everything being happy eternally, being freed from pain eternally. You know, I do well and I get a position, I have that eternally. I get money, I should have that eternally. Whatever is there, it should last eternally. But then the problem comes is in the material world, nothing's eternal. It's very, in fact, quite temporary. So because of this, then that throws doubt upon this. So then the elements of being happy eternally, then one turns from optimism, right, into pessimism. Optimism, you're going to think that, yes, I just deal with the world nicely, everything's going to be wonderful forever. When that starts to not work so well for you, then you become pessimistic, then you switch from the karma to jnana, that nothing here can make me happy. Therefore, I must get rid of the source of my unhappiness, which is the senses and the sense objects interacting with each other. The mind is the place where I feel pain. So if I get rid of the mind, the senses, which means the body, then I'll be happy. Right? At least that's so they think. But as defined by themselves, is that you can't have these things separate from each other. It is because of the sequential contact relationship that the whole process actuates. Otherwise, there would be no consciousness in the soul. See the contradiction here? Is that they're saying we're going to be liberated and therefore be freed from all misery because we get rid of the mind and the senses. So that means then they are feeling, are thinking they'll be conscious of that happy state from being freed from all difficulties. Right? But does that make sense? No, because Nyaya has made the statement that it is only when the mind, the senses, sense objects are all contacting with each other based on the memory, then you can say the person is conscious. They're saying, so the mind may be working, but you're not conscious. The mind, senses may be moving and seeing, but unless you focus on something, you're not conscious. You know what I'm saying? So here it is, they've already gone to great length to establish the nature of the soul, and its own consciousness is only complete when it comes all the way down to being able to perceive what's going on around you. Then they're going to remove that and now still claim that they're conscious, but that goes against the nature of the soul. And liberation is connection with the soul, not with the material world or something else. Does this make sense? We understand the point? So in other words, they've contradicted themselves. In other words, all these other philosophies, they always contradict themselves because of these points. Because they're motivated by they want to be happy. That happiness must be eternal. So some think that by engaging the senses and the sense objects, I will be happy eternally. But here they've understood that that's not going to create happiness. It creates misery ultimately. Therefore, I have to stop that process. So here's the materialistic element to it. Here's the bogus part. Right? Up to now, everything's been fine. Right? But now is the point where then we see bogusness comes in. Right? Does that make sense? Also here, the nature of the soul, they're defining the certain scientific elements, but they haven't defined where its origin coming from the Supreme Lord. They just, it's there. It's there. Everybody knows it's there. So they don't even talk about that. So already then, in the philosophy, that's where you see their mechanics are very, very nice. The mechanics of Nyaya we use. It's expected it will be used. It's the standard, it's the Vedic standard to work according to Nyaya. But having taken this Nyaya and then therefore, based on that, trying to make a philosophy where through Nyaya you explain the soul, the material energy, the Supreme Lord, the process of upliftment and the ultimate goal, that's where it becomes bogus. Does that make sense? Yes? So that's the differentiation. One has to be very careful. To obtain the state of liberation, one has to acquire true knowledge of the soul and of all the objects of experience. Right? That's how. Then they're going to do that through the Nyaya process. This knowledge is called tattvajnana, which means to know reality as completely distinct from unreality. Nyaya philosophy prescribes a three-stage path for reaching the goal of liberating knowledge. The first step is Shravana. Not bad. The study of the scriptures. So even the bogus philosophies say that's first. One has to study the spiritual scriptures and listen to authoritative persons and saints, right? Because they said only you can only get proper knowledge from the. In other words, your knowledge is based on Shabda that has come from those that are apta. Right? So from the saintly persons, then you gain knowledge. Right? The scriptures, which are the compilation of discussions between such personalities, and then scriptures that are written based on those by great personalities. Then you have the spiritual masters, then you have other practicing great personalities. All that together, that is your basis of knowledge. Then you are going to contemplate the world and try to see it. You get your proper knowledge. Following this, one must use his own reasoning powers to ponder over what he has learned. This process of rumination is called manana. Right? So this means that they're taking this from the Upanishads. Because when they say it's the six schools, it means they're taking from either some portion or various portions of the Veda. So we see this part, since liberation is his goal, it's taking from the Upanishads. Like that. While a karma mimamsa is taken from the Brahmanas. Because they're into rituals and everything like this. Finally, one must... So the process of manana. So here it just means contemplation, because here they're not necessarily applying it. That will be the difference. It means shravana. Our definition of shravana will be the same. Manana will take that part of it, but we will also practically apply it. finally, one must contemplate on the soul, confirm his knowledge, and practice that truth in his life. This is called Nididhyasana. Right, so that means you're dealing with the soul. So the level of soul of Brahman, that's realization. You could say that's knowledge that you're gaining through the senses and understanding the relationships, that's knowledge. Like that. Or what you've gained through hearing, that's knowledge. Then through manana and practice of that, then you gain what is called vijnana, or realized knowledge. So that necessarily should be in connection with the soul. Right? It means, of course, someone may be realized in material activities and be, you know, have a good understanding of that. But that's not the realization. That's not the level of Nididhyasana that we're talking about here, or of manana. Right? Shravana, you're hearing about the absolute truth and its relationship with the material world. Manana, you're contemplating that, applying that in your life. Nididhyasana, you come and understand your relationship with the Supreme Lord in the material world. Right? But since they've left the Supreme Lord out of this, therefore there's no need of devotional service. Does that make sense? So there's no need of application, practical application of manana. So their Nididhyasana can never go beyond the liberated platform, just the knowledge of the soul, because they don't know Godhead. A material nature is what you deal with the senses. So through the senses, you deal with material nature. You try to understand, therefore, the nature of the soul. Right? When that's understood, then that realization, that's Nididhyasana. You understand? Do we see how these terms work? They're overlapping. Right? In other words, the person, the Karmakandi, he hears from his authorities about the ritual and the importance of ritual and pious activities and the attainment of the heavenly planets, or the attainment of material happiness. Then he contemplates that manana, right, and practices that by his rituals and by his proper behavior. Then he gets realization on actually how to properly be always situated in the state of happiness due to the proper performance of pious activities. Understand? Yes? So then here the process is, Shravana, you hear from authorities, but here instead of just hearing about the ritualistic activities coming from authorities, you're hearing about actually the higher principles, right? More of the philosophy and all that. Then you contemplate that, but since your goal is to become liberated from material activities, there's no practical application on engaging the senses with this practice of manana, right? It's simply the mental speculation. Right? So then from there you will get realization, but that realization will be in connection with the soul and the state of liberation. Right? You'll be freed from material activities because you've never applied your knowledge, what you've heard from Shravana, practically. Yes? And so therefore all you're going to get is liberation. That makes sense? So that's their definition. Then for the Vaishnav, Shravanam, you're hearing from authority on the position of the Supreme Lord, ourselves, material world, and devotional service, and how coming to the platform of pure love of God is our ultimate goal. Right? Then from there you're going to contemplate that and apply that practically in your life by rendering devotional service. That will come to the point of getting realization where then this devotional service is what is all that is important to you. Right? Does that make sense? So in other words, you can see in completeness of the process, the karmi and the bhakti yogi are similar. They use all the aspects. Right? In other words, they use both aspects of manana. Therefore, they also get, besides an experiential, also observable forms of their activity, right? While for the jnanis, then their manana doesn't include practical application, right? So then their experience of liberation is only that. They don't actually have a practical application of it. Does that make sense?
That's not for us us, manana,
we mean
buddhi yoga, right?
For us, manana. Manana means buddhi yoga, yes. That you're, in other words, through you're engaging the body, mind, and words in the Lord's service according to the knowledge you've heard. Right? Because otherwise, if you just engage the body, then depending upon if one's very sincere, that will gain give knowledge and detachment. One will get that. But it may not be very technical, but one will get it, but it will be essential. It will be functional. If one has knowledge but doesn't apply it so much in practical service, one may get a nice realization of the Lord, but it will be in tattva, it won't be in rasa. Because rasa is experienced through interaction. Does that make sense? So that's why you need the practical application. In other words, one is the tattva, the other is the rasa. Right? One is the theory and all that, one is the practical application. Yes? No? Does all this make sense? Yes.
So would you be using the same scriptures like Bhakti Yogi and Bhakti Yogi Devasis Upanishad?
That means in knowledge, the yogi, the jnani and the devotee will be similar. In activities, the devotee and the karmi will be similar. Right? That's what makes devotional service unique. Because the karmi acts but doesn't have very complete knowledge. Or doesn't put an emphasis on let's say, the more metaphysical knowledge. Right? Skills, yes, but metaphysical knowledge, no. Right? The jnani puts it on knowledge and not actually on skills. Right? But the devotee puts it on both knowledge and skills. That combination makes it unique. That's why it's not complete. When you see that sometimes they translate Shravana Manana Nididhyasana as knowledge, skills, and values. Right? You bumped into this? Or? Can't say. No? Oh, okay. But take the manana as your skills. So when you have knowledge of something, then you practice it. But the point is unless there is a higher knowledge by which you're practicing it, what results you're going to get. If you just get the thing enough to do the skill, that knowledge, then you'll get the result of the skill. But if you're practicing, if you're understanding in that knowledge, it has the theory of the skill and the philosophy that goes behind it. Then when you come to the skill point, you'll be contemplating the philosophical aspects along with the culture and practical application. Then when you get results, then it will be, you'll actually have the result of the skill and the result of that actual devotional contemplation. Does that make sense? So you will get the result, the observable result of a skill. You will be liberated from material connection and you will have devotion. Right? Because otherwise, without the philosophy, how do you know if your skill is favorable to Krishna? How do you know that skill, you're not separating it from Krishna? That's the difficulty. Does that make sense? So that's why it's important that all these things are put together. That's why these subtleties are done, because as you go into the subtleties, one can find points where one thought it was just straight Krishna consciousness, but actually in how we contemplate it, it's not complete enough. Therefore, there's some problem. Or, it is complete, but we just didn't know how to express it. And now we learn the technicalities, we know how to express it. Does that make sense? So in other words, one is more fixed and focused on how to properly perform the devotional activities because one understands the science. Or by understanding the science, one understands that it wasn't complete, my execution of Krishna consciousness. And so one is able to therefore make it better. So in either case, it improves. Right? Does that make sense? Yes? No? Through the practice of Shravana, Manana, and Nididhyasana, a person realizes the true nature of the soul as being totally distinct from the body, mind, senses, and all other objects of the world. The truth realized within dispels the darkness of self-identification and misunderstanding, mitya jnana, concerning I-ness and thy-ness. I guess I-ness and thy-ness, or it could be I-ness and my-ness. When this happens, a person ceases to be moved by his passions and impulses and begins to perform his duties selflessly without having any desire to reap the fruits of these actions. The fire of true knowledge roasts one's past karma like seeds, thereby making them unable to germinate. Thus, true knowledge leads a person to the state where there is no cycle of birth and death. The state is called liberation. So we see is that the definition here that they give is, then we see when it is practical definition, it is very possible to come to that state. But at the same time, is that state that they describe is not actually eternal. Because then, what is, if one's goal is simply to be in that state, how can you keep yourself there? Because you're only there as long as you're consciously in that state. Problem is that that state doesn't mean you won't be born again. So when you're born again, then there's going to be a problem. Any sense? And especially since you're basically wiping the memory clean of all these different things because you're only working on the Brahman platform. You'll have memory for skills and this and that, but other things in the world aren't so important, so you don't have that value system. But you've come to the platform of liberation from having been frustrated from all these things that you've experienced in your memories. So then when you take birth again, then even though you're very pure, you don't actually necessarily have an understanding that the material world is a problem. So therefore, what's going to be your drive to remain in that selfless condition to keep yourself free from material contamination? Does that make sense? So in your next life, you'll be born very pious, very elevated. But at the same time, what's the drive to keep you from getting entangled again? Does that make sense? So it's a problem. Because still, you don't actually know what the soul is, what the material world is, what God is. You still don't know. Therefore, it's only in devotional service that then this becomes complete. Then that working for that selfless without having any desires to reap the fruits. Okay, it's nice that you've come to the platform of nice karma, but it's, I mean, it's, in other words, nice karma is the bottom of the beginning stage of yoga. It's the top of the beginning stage of yoga, but it's the bottom of the advanced stage of yoga. Right? In other words, in the beginning stages of yoga, I do things for myself. Right? Then I get the concept of that I should not do this for myself, I should do it for others. Then I come to the state of being able to function by doing my prescribed duties without any attachment to the result. Right? Sounds glorious. But where is Krishna in all this? Therefore, it may be the top stage of a beginner's program, but then in the advanced stages, it's the bottom. From there, okay, now you're acting without any material desire for yourself. Great. Now, the point is that, but who are you, why work in that state? Just because it's good, it's nice? Because in this case, then, you know, if it's by karma, it's good, nice, others will benefit. You'll get good material result. Or from the jnana side, is if I work in this state, I will not be unhappy because I have no desires. Therefore, if desires aren't fulfilled, I won't, you know, that is the cause of suffering. I won't experience that. Right? So therefore, it's nice, it's very pious on the platform of karma and jnana. But the point is you're giving up this as sacrifice to a living entity that is beyond your bodily connection. You know what I'm saying? A family, of community, of nation, of just life in the world. You know what I'm saying? Brotherly love, whatever it may be. Or you can't say brotherly love, that's not broad enough, right? Sisterly love also would leave something out. So I say, platonic, that's between, yeah, it's a general, but this would mean of all persons.
Universal love.
Universal love, yes, okay. So then you have this universal love. But still, the point is that it's still not, it's generic. You like all people, but you don't like anyone in particular. So then you have to start taking it, and you're reversing what you started from. You did it just for yourself. And then you pull back, well, it's better not to be just for yourself, you have to consider others. Then you work from a completely selfless platform. But that selflessness then needs to be directed. So you maintain the selflessness, but then you direct it towards Krishna. So when you come to the platform that, in pure love, you do everything simply for His pleasure, that is the culmination of this selflessness. You understand? So they're only working on the top platform of the neophyte stage. You have to be very advanced to be on this platform, yes, but spiritually it's not actually that advanced. It's the first level of spiritual advance. I mean, spiritual categorization. It may be the last stage in material consideration. Does that make sense? So in the material world, someone who's, you know, liberated is very great. But on the spiritual platform, that's the beginning. Developing love for Krishna, that's special. Okay? But that doesn't mean you make snide comments about someone who actually is liberated. It's not a bad position to perform your devotional service from. Right? Does that make sense? Okay, now he says we roast the past karma seeds. Now we know from that it only happens in devotional service. So in their minds it's roasted. But the problem is down the line they actually need the taste of relationship rather than just the happiness of not being involved in relationships, so there's no pain coming from that. So then they will go back. You know what I'm saying? They will go back. That's the problem with this, is that it sounds very nice, very clean, very straightforward, but it's taken out the personal aspect that the soul is still a person. And so therefore needs a relationship. Because otherwise, how do you just live on the no I-ness, thy-ness, there's no yours, mine, this, that. That's great. But the point is, that doesn't mean you can't have a relationship. You know what I'm saying? One says to have relationship, there can't be any, you know, these higher points of philosophy. Others say to establish the philosophy, there can't be any points of relationship. That's why karma and jnana are always have a problem. But Buddha yoga means that both are connected. Right? It means one one is not acting on for one's own personal benefit. One's working for Krishna's benefit, but one is still performing activities. Right? You're performing selfless activities for Krishna's pleasure. Right? So that's the difference. Is that these other schools, karma and jnana, will say selfless work for you know, just selfless work. So whether it's for others or whether it's for liberation, you know, that selfless work for others' benefit then gives you a higher sense of material pleasure. Or that selfless work, you know, getting rid of all concepts of I and mine, then that brings you to the liberated platform. But both of them are mundane. Does that make sense? Yes? Yeah. So he's saying, so thus true knowledge leads a person to the state where there's no cycle of birth and death. This state is called liberation. But true knowledge means one's relationship with God. That is eternal liberation. Otherwise, they will get this state, but it will be temporary, because the seeds weren't actually destroyed. They just won't come up now. And because you don't actually know Krishna, you can't get into the spiritual world, so you have to come back to the material world as desires come up again. So that there's the shortcoming there. Because otherwise, before this, the system is working fairly good. Right? The concept of God. Now he'll probably have more fun here. According to Nyaya, God is considered to be the operative cause of creation, maintenance and destruction of the universe. God does not create the world out of nothing or out of himself, but rather out of the eternal atoms of space, time, mind, and soul. So this is close to the... We'll see that, because the next is Vaisheshika. So at this point they're very similar, because sometimes they even group the two together. Gotama Vaisheshika, because of this point here. The concept of God, the creation, is very similar. So they just use the logic of one, and I'm not exactly... and more the atomic theory of the other, and then they come up with all kinds of strange and wonderful things. So now the thing is he doesn't create it out of nothing. So that's good. That's an appropriate thing. Not like modern scientists that you're going to get this unlimited creation out of nothingness. You know, something squashed into one place that it's so... But if it's squashed into one place, then they say nothing is there, but you squash anything, it becomes hot. So why isn't heat there? You know, but of course, if there's an explosion, meant there had to be heat. But the point is that if that's its natural state, something of its natural state, then it wouldn't explode, it would open. Like a bud has everything in it and then it opens. So if it is actually condensed to the point where it would explode, that means there's fire, that means there had to have been a force to condense it. Otherwise, how would it explode? Does that make sense? Explosions don't happen naturally in nature. Right? There has to be some impression upon on one energy by another. Then there can be explosions. So out of nothing, then that's good, because that means it's theistic, not theistic. It's what do you call it? Astika means it accepts the Vedas. So in that way, it's not atheistic. But from another thing is, but nor out of himself. Then where do you get this from? So then you see that you get this point of that you have a God, but like the other monotheists or that, then you have the element of deifying the Lord. So God and his creation are separate. Because it's not made out of him, then what's it made out of? So that means then you have to define, you know, that means that the material energy stands on its own. And we see as the soul comes out of material energy. So they're actually a form of materialist. You understand? So this is, you understand what? So that's why this, what the definition of the soul, definition of the material energy, and definition of God, then you can determine where they stand in their philosophy. So right now we can see that the interesting combination, this nyaya, of materialism, because the soul and everything's coming out of material nature. You have the element of gyan, because your purpose is liberation. And at the same time, then they have this idea that there's a Supreme Lord who is deified, who's separated from the existence. Right? So you put that together, and it sounds pretty familiar. You know what I'm saying? Modern society, and everything's based on, you know, it's got to be logical, everything like this. You know, then you know, there is a supreme God, but he's not actually in connection here. So it's us, it's our dealing with the material energy, the success or failure. God actually doesn't have really anything to do with it, like that. Does that make sense? And ultimately, then it's impersonal. Sound like any world religion you know? Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, they all do this. Anytime they accept the Supreme, then they all do this because they're dealing on the mundane platform. That makes sense. Okay. Rather, eternal atoms of space, time, mind, and soul. The creation of the universe refers to the ordering of these eternal entities, which are in coexistence with God, into a mortal world. So we also agree with the coexistence, but the point is the source is the Lord Himself. Otherwise, where is going to be the source? It's not logical. It's not explained. Where does it come from? But if you want to have an impersonal conclusion, then you have to not say it comes from God, because if it came from God, where would be the question of impersonal conclusion? Right? So those attached to impersonalism, they bring in the element of God here, and that's why is Nyaya still practiced? Because of this element of God. You make that very strong, and then that remains. You don't have the personal element, then there's a problem. So even Buddhism, in its pure state, as Buddhism, it hasn't been practiced since the lifetime of Buddha. In the lifetime of Buddha, pure Buddhism was actually destroyed. So even your present-day Buddhists, they get up to a point, they talk about, you know, the Buddha and the gods and things like that, the original Adi Buddha, like that. I think it's the Mahayana, is that the Buddha is, you know, he's blue, he has four arms, you know, like that. So they have the personal form, but they don't talk about that to the general public. So therefore it keeps it alive. Otherwise, if it wasn't, then it would have died a long time ago. Okay, we're all right. Okay, so, yeah. Thus, God as the first operative cause of the universal world, of the universe, universal forces, is the creator of the world. And God is also the preserver, as he causes the atoms to hold together and continue their existence in a particular order that maintains the physical universe. God is also called the destroyer of the universe, because he lets loose the forces of destruction when the energies of the mortal world require it. God is one, infinite, and eternal, and the universe and the universe's space-time of mind and soul does not limit him. God is said to possess six perfections: infinite glory, absolute sovereignty, unqualified virtue, supreme beauty, perfect knowledge, and complete detachment. So they also accept these things, but you see, it's because they separate him from his creation, then technically speaking, it's atheistic. Like that. Vedic, but atheistic. Okay, starting to appreciating these points here, how one has to know these things, then one can explain. Because otherwise, they're taking God as, you know, they're taking him beyond what the modern world religions will attribute to God. But at the same time, as he creates everything, means he creates by putting in that energy that holds it together. He maintains it by holding it together, and he destroys it by letting it go. Then it just goes back to what it was. Does that make sense? Right? But they're not establishing that it actually is his eternal energy. That's the difficulty. Let's see as we go. Okay. Om Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Shila Prabhupada ki. Yeah.